Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back to Where is Bruce Schuller? This is episode 5, Ghost Evidence. My name is Graham Crowley and thank you very much for listening. This podcast has been created for an adult audience. There are adult themes discussed, so listener discretion is advised. The thoughts and opinions in this podcast are mine. Yes, another episode name change in case you missed it. Whilst researching the case, I couldn't help but change the name of this episode. It felt more appropriate, as you'll see. This is one of the things I love about broadcasting true crime. You just never know what is going to pop up out of the box. Just when you think you have heard and seen everything, along comes a case like Bruce Schuller. If I had to summarise this case in one sentence, it would be this. What the jury heard did not reflect what the witnesses told the police. And of course, I'll expand on that. And it is fitting and appropriate to broadcast this episode today, Friday, 29 December, 2023. It would have been Bruce Schuller's 60th birthday. But instead of celebrating his life with family and friends, his family are still looking for his remains so they can give him a proper burial. And finally, we are getting to the truth, the core of what happened that day, almost 11.5 years since his disappearance and murder. We are not there yet, but we are well on the way. An order has been placed for a jumbo box of red flags. You heard the Crown case starting to unravel in episode 4. I am still stunned that evidence remained buried for 11 years. I'm pleased I played a part in telling the story. I could regale you with at least a full further episode, if not more, of the extensive problems with the Crown case. Discrepancies in the evidence, obfuscation, dissembling, evasive and deceitful answers, changing the storyline to suit the narrative, and in some instances straight-out lies. But why bother talking about matters that were seemingly made up to confuse and bluster when we can go straight to the crux of this case? Before I get into that material, I want to explain the defence position at trial. And I'm sure I do not need to clarify this, but just in case. The defendants Stephen and Diane were tried separately, but together, if that makes sense. They each had a barrister representing solely them. It would have been possible, for example, that one may have been found guilty whilst the other found not guilty. The barristers knew the defence position the defendants had adopted. The police knew. The only ones in the dark, really, were the jury and the majority of the general public. And the defence position is extremely relevant And as we will hear, it dovetails nicely with the Crown evidence. Who would have thought that was ever possible? Not that that was even known until now. Diane did not give evidence and did not call evidence, as was her right. I assume she decided to have the Crown prove their case against her if they were capable of so doing. I have since read she regrets that decision and believes she should have given evidence. Not that it would have made one iota of difference to the outcome of the trial, in my opinion. Stephen Struber did give evidence. You heard my conversation with Monty Dwyer in an earlier episode. In my opinion, it is a brave or naive defendant who enters the witness box in a murder trial. Leaving aside any defence strategies, of course. Far better to have the Crown prove their case against you if they can. As it transpires, Stephen Struber giving evidence now works to their advantage. Not that it did at the trial. The following is part of the cross-examination of Stephen Struber by the Crown prosecutor. These are their words, but not their voices. The first part referred to the condition of the gearbox of the Toyota Land Cruiser, the Bush Basher, which I was going to discuss in a later episode. But after what comes out in this episode, that will no longer be necessary.
And you told Mr. Feeney just now that there were some difficulties with first and second gear?
That's correct.
However, on the 9th of July, you could select first gear if you were careful, couldn't you?
Yes.
And you could select second gear if you were careful?
Yes.
And at this point, the prosecutor questions Stephen Struber about the crime.
I want to put a number of propositions to you, and you can agree or you can disagree. Now, you know the gully we were talking about, don't you?
Yeah.
And to get to the gully from the homestead, you would drive over the Palmer River and go along the track, along the Palmer River, and then up the track. And the gully would be on your left, correct?
Yes.
On the 9th of July 2012, you drove up that track, didn't you?
No.
You drove up that track with Diane as a passenger?
No.
And whilst you were driving up that track, Diane gestured down to the gully, didn't she?
No, we weren't in that area.
Well, I am suggesting to you, you were. And you were there about 9:30 a.m.
Were not.
And I am also going to suggest to you that you stopped that ute and Diane got out.
We weren't in the area.
Do you carry weapons in your ute?
Yes.
A .357 revolver handgun?
Yes.
A .22 bolt-action rifle?
Yes.
You had your revolver with you that day, didn't you?
No, I didn't.
Going back to the gully, Diane got out of that vehicle and pulled a weapon, didn't she?
We weren't there.
You weren't there?
We weren't there.
Did Diane shoot at Bruce Schuller?
Like I'm saying, we weren't there.
Did you shoot at Bruce Schuller?
I was out. Both of us were out at the dam. We weren't there.
You then drove up the track and drove down that slope, didn't you?
We weren't there.
You shot Bruce Schuller, didn't you?
I did not. We were out at the dam doing the work that I've already mentioned earlier.
So you fired the second shot at Bruce Schuller?
We weren't there.
Diane's fired the second shot at Bruce Schuller.
We weren't there.
You drove down that slope, didn't you?
We weren't there.
Well, you caused the tracks that went down that slope.
Couldn't have, because we weren't there.
Are you saying to this court and to this jury?
Yes.
That you have never driven a vehicle down that slope?
Yes.
Diane drove the vehicle down the slope.
Diane wasn't there.
You disposed of Bruce Schuller's body?
We weren't there.
You burnt the grass at that, on the bottom of that slope, didn't you?
We weren't there.
And you did that to dispose of evidence, didn't you?
We weren't there.
And later,
what did you do with that Winchester?
Never had anything to do with it.
What did Diane do with that Winchester?
As far as I know, she didn't have anything to do with it either.
And you've got two weapons missing as well?
One.
One?
One.
What weapon is that?
Pistol.
I put to you that you disposed of both of those weapons.
I didn't.
I put to you that you know Diane disposed of those weapons.
She didn't.
Struber's evidence left his barrister, Mr. Feeney, with a conundrum. Where the defendant denies being the killer, the barrister does not necessarily need to present an alternate proposition. But in this case, I would think the jury would be looking for a reason why they should not believe the prospectors. The only alternate position was the prospectors murdered Bruce. There was no other possibility, really. And enter Kevin Groth, stage left. Longtime friend of Bruce, known prospectors Bidner and Anderson one day. Struber's barrister would be asking the jury to accept that Kevin Groth conspired with two men he had only just met to murder his mate of 20 years, or was threatened by them and has remained mute all this time. And it gets worse. The barrister would also be asking the jury to accept Queensland police totally miss the clues, the inconsistencies, the innuendo that the prospectors blindsided them and had fabricated the entire story. A preposterous allegation. Seasoned detectives missing something so obvious. Declining to give evidence as Diane had done and having the Crown prove their case suddenly had a lot of appeal, I would think. That left his barrister to somehow deal with the rather dodgy hand he'd been dealt. A great outcome for the Crown prosecutor, not so good for either defence counsel. If the jury was wobbly before Stephen Struber gave evidence, pretty sure that was sorted afterwards. But back to the storyline. It was concluded Bruce Shuler likely died of gunshot wounds, even though there was no body, no death certificate, and no official cause of death. You heard some of the details in previous episodes. The police said so. A strong circumstantial case. In the last episode, we canvassed what happened at the time Diane fired the first shot, or didn't. And I do not propose to go there again. But what happened after the first shot is the crux of this whole case. And I cannot believe it was not canvassed at trial. It has always been there, hiding in plain sight. And not even hiding, really. The police knew. The prosecutor knew. One defence barrister commented, in the absence of the jury, on the short distance the ute travelled, and then never raised it again. I can find no explanation for the barrister's inaction. The judge knew. He commented on it whilst everyone was focused on whether the bush basher could drive up the ravine. My best guess, his comment was ignored. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, I need you to understand a premise. The Crown prosecutor asked the jury to accept the evidence of the prospectors. He presented the prospectors as truthful witnesses, honest witnesses. He did not contest or want to clarify any part of their evidence. By default, therefore, he accepted all their evidence as being truthful and accurate. However, he did add a proviso in summing up when he said, "I concede there were inconsistencies in their evidence." A most unusual comment by a prosecutor, in my opinion. On the Crown case, after Struber stopped the vehicle beside Bruce at the first crime scene, the Strubers drove 200 metres to the second crime scene, at the bottom of the gully. There, they murdered Bruce Shuler, apparently with a .357 bullet. To get there, they needed to drive approximately 80 metres along the track in an almost northerly direction. In other words, away from the direction of the homestead. They then needed to turn left and drive approximately 80 metres along a rough dirt track. The track referred to in this podcast and at trial as the earlobe. The Strubers then needed to drive down a steep ravine for approximately 40 metres. So steep, they needed to be in first gear, low range, crawling along. After murdering Bruce and placing his body on the tray of the ute, the Strubers needed to drive 40 metres back up the ravine again. So steep, they needed to be in first gear, low range, again, crawling along with the engine revving loudly. After climbing up the 40 metres out of the steep ravine, the killers then needed to drive 80 metres back along the earlobe to the main track, turn right, and then drive back past where Diane fired the first shot and onto the homestead. That was a crown case. There are photos of the steep ravine on the Facebook pages. In one photo, if you look closely, you can see people in bright yellow SES overalls at the base of the ravine. To give you an idea of the distance from top to bottom and the steepness of the ground. In another photo on the Facebook page, the phrase tyre marks is written. Tyre marks are also marked on one mud map. Prospectors Bidner and Anderson repeatedly said in interviews, statements and reenactments, the vehicle only travelled 20 metres after the first shot was fired and then turned around and returned to the homestead. And according to Anderson, it travelled that 20 metres at walking speed. Think about it. How do you place the killers at the second crime scene when your witnesses say they didn't go there? And that dovetails in, as I said, with what Stephen Struber said. He said they were not there. The Crown witnesses said the ute did not go there. How very bizarre. Prosecutor Reese, you knew that before trial, yet you prosecuted regardless. How was that problem addressed? As strange as it may seem, by simply not telling the jury about that evidence. The prosecutor did not ask the witnesses about that evidence at trial. He did not raise it in summing up. Debate is raging on whether Prosecutor Rees should have led that evidence and put it before the jury. One legal expert I spoke with said the prosecutor had an obligation to produce that evidence. Another said the prosecutor's obligation did not extend that far, and the onus was on defence counsel to ensure it was placed before the jury. But both experts absolutely agreed that evidence should have been placed before the jury. Whatever the correct answer, that very compelling evidence did not see the light of day in that courtroom. It was almost like it was ghost evidence. And that is not the first time I've said that phrase, light of day, in this podcast. You may recall I said this in episode 4. After Groth left the witness box, it was evident the inconvenient truth that he believed the weapon to be a .30-30 fired into the air did not see the light of day in that courtroom. I do hope there are no other examples of evidence that did not get to see the light of day waiting to be discovered. How can a jury be expected to reach an informed verdict when significant evidence is withheld from them? Instead, the prosecutor told the jury they could infer the Strubers drove to the bottom of the steep ravine. Based on what I thought? As I understand it, originally based on the now discredited matching tyre evidence and the scrape mark on the anthill, consistent with having been caused by an object such as the underneath of a vehicle, possibly the unregistered Land Cruiser. So I guess you could add there, possibly not the unregistered Land Cruiser. Well, excuse me, how could you infer that? And why were the defence counsel not on their feet telling the jury quite clearly the evidence showed the vehicle returned to the homestead? That was the very nexus of the Palmerville murder. In case you are in any doubt about what the jury did and didn't hear, I have added significant portions of evidence here to explain. You heard Prospector Bidner say in episode 4, these are his words, but not his voice.
I then heard a vehicle start up and drive off. It didn't go far and it stopped. It sounded like it only drove 20 yards, and then maybe 10 to 15 minutes later, there was a second gunshot.
Roughly 20 metres. So it did not even make it to the turnoff where the track goes off to the left, to the earlobe. Not 200 metres. Bidner did not give evidence he heard the ute go along the earlobe. He did not give evidence he heard the ute go down the steep ravine, crawling along in low range first gear. He did not give evidence he heard the ute drive back up the steep ravine in low range first gear with the engine revving. Nor was he questioned by any of the three barristers in the courtroom about those critical issues. At trial, Bidner said this at page 4/23, talking about the time immediately after the first gunshot. These are his words, but not his voice.
Then it had started up again and then drove ashore. Because I was out of sight then, I was just listening and I heard the vehicle move a short distance, guessing, you know, I don't know, 50 metres. I don't know. I heard the vehicle start up, didn't go through any gears or anything, and then stop again.
Again, he made it clear the vehicle did not go as far as 80 metres to the turn-off left. And as I said, he did not give evidence that he heard the vehicle go along the earlobe, up or down the ravine, nor back along the earlobe. And this is what he said in the reenactment video by police. These are his words and his voice.
What can you tell me about this position here that we're standing at
this
the moment?
This is a position I walked to. After hearing the first gunshot, I thought, shit, I better get out of the way. So I've come back over here. I've squatted down there and sat there and then heard the second gunshot. And then I've waited. And then I heard the vehicle start probably 15, 20 minutes went past. And then I heard the vehicle start up. I got up off there. I was sitting there just below that peg. And then I walked up here because I could hear the vehicle coming along the river here. So I got up here just to check the vehicle going past. And I just observed the top of the roof of the vehicle, and I observed that it was the same vehicle I'd observed at the first position I'd showed you, and I took for granted that that was Struber and Diane Struber and Stephen Struber leaving the scene.
Okay, just as you said you can see the vehicle driving past.
Yep.
In which direction is the vehicle going?
The vehicle was heading back to Palmerville Station, to the homestead.
Okay.
Bidner did not mention the vehicle starting or stopping, but you heard him say he heard it and saw it go back toward the homestead. In point 83 of his police statement, he said, referring to the vehicle returning to the Palmerville station, the following. These are his words, but not his voice.
Then I hear the car start up again. From my position, I heard the car start up and drive back the way it came towards the homestead, heading in a westerly direction down the river.
Bidner consistently said over 3 years that the vehicle only drove 20 metres or so. A shot was heard, and then the vehicle was heard to turn around and drive back to the homestead. Nowhere did he say he heard or saw it go down the gully. There was absolutely no way of inferring that it went down the gully from his evidence. What did Tremaine Anderson have to say? In his police statement of 10 July 2012, he said in part the following, at point 31. These are his words, but not his voice.
There was then a delay of, say, 15 minutes, in which time I kept walking through the scrub back towards the car. I then sat down again beside a tree and rolled a smoke and listened. The car then started up again, and I heard it drive a little further up the road. From what I heard, I assumed that it drove a little bit further up the gully where I had seen Bruce. I then heard another shot fire off. Then it was all quiet for about half an hour. I then heard the car start up again. I heard it traveling along the road. I could not see it from where I was, but from the noise, it was traveling back down the river from the way it had originally come back towards the homestead, Palmerville Station. I have drawn a picture of the area where I last seen Bruce, where I saw the car. I have given this to police.
And as you may recall, I have placed copies of his diagram on the Facebook pages, one with highlights. If you look closely, you can see he placed the car stopping only a short distance further up the track. No drawing of it turning left and going along the earlobe. No drawing of it going down to the creek bed. What Tremaine had to say during the reenactment with police was significant. So much so, I have placed a recording of the conversation here. This is the actual Queensland Police Service audio, and some of it is scratchy. These are his words and his voice.
And then what's happened then?
Well, I've actually proceeded to move now.
Yep, okay. And where have you, just point, where have you moved to?
I've gone down across this gully.
Yep.
That feeder coming in on the other side over there.
Yep.
I would have crossed that feeder. Now I'm trying to get distance. Now, if you look on that little rise over there,
mm-hmm.
you see the next gully?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I've stayed for now, right through to the second shot.
Okay.
And the second shot and the vehicle then going after half an hour of silence.
Okay. So when you got to that position, how long were you there before you heard the second shot?
Well, it would have been about, it would have been about 15 minutes, something like that, I presume, 15, 20 minutes or something maybe, before the vehicles then started up, proceeded to go further up the road. It stopped. Then I've heard another shot again ring out. High-powered shot, and it seemed to me the direction of the bullet was shot upstream somewhere. This one seemed to be shot close by, like close.
Mm-hmm.
This one seemed, I thought I heard the bullet travel, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll just run through. You've been in this position, you've
yep.
heard the first shot, then the clang.
Yep.
You've run over to the next gully.
Yeah.
You've got there, and then what's the next thing that you heard?
The next one, so I got to that spot.
Yep.
The vehicle has proceeded to drive up to the road. I've heard the next shot.
Okay, then, so you've heard the vehicle move again?
Yeah.
Okay, have you heard any other noises or nothing?
No.
Okay, how long did you hear that vehicle moving for?
Oh, it would have only been a minute or two tops. It only just went around the corner, just went, you know. I could probably imagine if we go over there, had I stood up, I might have even been able to see it, you know.
Okay.
Had I taken the time to look, I might have been able to view it.
Yep, okay. So you didn't see the vehicle from that position?
No.
Okay.
Mind you, I didn't try and look. I was actually just sat down.
And what speed do you think that vehicle was travelling?
Very slow.
Very slowly?
Very slow. Walking distance or a bit faster.
Okay. So you've heard that vehicle move.
Yep.
And then what's the next thing you've heard?
I've heard a pull up.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard a loud gunshot again.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just complete silence for a half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, nothing could be heard. Not a... Nothing, just the wind, because it was about the time Steve and Diane drove up out of the river that the wind come up,
mm-hmm.
you know, so this is what I'm saying. It would have been around 10 o'clock or something like that, and the wind blew up.
Yeah.
And so I had the wind against me, so I had the wind coming this way. I couldn't hear.
You know?
Bugger all, really. I heard the car pull up, I heard the shot, and then it was a half an hour of silence just with the wind. Then I heard the car start up again. Turn around and proceed to head back the way it had come.
Okay. Did you actually see it turn around and proceed back?
No,
okay.
But I heard it. Plain as day.
Okay.
Well, how
come you believe it proceeded back the way it came?
Well, it definitely come back down this track, most definitely. And then later on in the day, like I'd explained in my statement, I run all the gullies and that right through to Palmerville Homestead. And I seen it actually up on the road here where it had turned around.
What did you see?
I just seen where the tracks had turned around.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So that half an hour has passed, the vehicle's then proceeded back towards the creek.
Yep.
What have you done then?
Well, then I've gone across to the next gully or two.
Yeah.
And I've just sat there for probably about another half an hour, 15, 20 minutes maybe.
Yeah.
In which case, I heard some first noise above me. See, I didn't want to do too much then because I thought to myself, what if she's dropped Stephen off with a gun and she's driven off?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. if he's chasing us. See, Stephen's old thing in the past was, I thought it was weird that they'd gone, because normally he'd chase you, he'd try and track you, he'd try and find your camp, you know? That's just what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I've sat there for a bit longer. Next minute I've heard some grass or tree, people walk, or somebody walking, you know, cracks, noises. I'll turn up and I'll look through the bushes and so I see Dan coming back across the ridge over here. I've gone, hey, bro, what are you doing?
At the 55-second mark, Anderson stated he heard the vehicle start up again and proceed further up the road. It stopped. Then I heard another shot ring out, he said. At the 1 minute 43-second mark, in response to being asked how long he heard the vehicle moving for, he replied, only a minute or two, tops. It only just went around the corner. I heard the car pull up. Then the shot. Then I heard the car start up again, turn around, and proceed back the way it had come. He heard the car turn around. At the 3 minute 20 second mark, he claimed to have seen the tracks on the road where it had turned around. The following is evidence you did not hear from witness Anderson. He did not give evidence he heard the ute go along the earlobe. He did not give evidence he heard the ute go down the steep ravine in low range first. He did not give evidence he heard the ute drive back up the steep ravine in low range first with the engine revving. Nor was he questioned by any of the three barristers in the courtroom about those matters. And from further questioning, Anderson stated the vehicle travelled back toward the homestead after about half an hour. You heard Anderson say in the reenactment he went to the spot where the car did a U-turn. That spot was about 100 metres north of where the shot was allegedly fired by Diane, a claim he denied at trial, by the way. I wonder why that was. He corroborated Bidner about the distance the vehicle travelled after Diane fired the shot. And this reenactment was recorded 3 days after Bruce went missing. For 3 years, Anderson maintained the same story. The vehicle travelled a short distance, stopped, turned around, and returned to the homestead. Yet, you heard Prosecutor Rees tell the jury they could infer the defendants went to the bottom of the gully. Sorry, Prosecutor, all I can infer is that the defendants were never anywhere near that gully that day, according to your witnesses. They were not the only secrets the evidence gave up. If there was any doubt, those few short days after Bruce's disappearance, whether Bruce was dead or alive, Anderson seemingly clarified that for us in the same reenactment video. He started off talking in the present tense about Bruce, but then switched to the past tense. I don't think Tremaine expected Bruce to return anytime soon and become one of his prospecting buddies. These are his words and his voice.
How long have you known Bruce for?
I've only met him once before I'd come out this trip.
Mm-hmm.
And that was only briefly one night at Dan's place. When he was, I think he had a truck and he was bringing a load of something in for his camp. We do have mutual friends and that. I know people and know him and all the rest of it. And then just this trip, you know, I'd gone, just the other week before, we'd gone up to Cradle, taking myself, Bruce and Dan for a ride, bit of detecting. And yeah, I just thought he was going to be one of the team, you know, because we got on well. He seemed, Gold hadn't screwed with his brain. He seemed like a nice guy, you know.
Okay. Had there been any disagreements or arguments between the four of you at all?
Not a chance, no.
No?
No, not a chance, no. No, no, bloody nice. Okay. He was a nice guy, mate. Yeah.
You said that you'd found gold the day before.
Yep.
Had anyone else found gold?
No.
How much gold did you find?
It was about an ounce for the afternoon.
And how much is that worth?
Probably only about 1,400 after impurities and that are taken out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in the last few weeks, had any of the four of you found a large amount of gold at all?
No, not at all.
No? Okay. And when you find your gold, if you all come out to one spot like you did that day, is that just yours, or is it something that gets shared around?
Well, some crews offer do things differently, but the way we've always done it, ever since I've been a prospector, what you find is yours.
Yeah.
Because you might work harder than the next bloke, this, that, and the other.
And what about Schultz? I mean, Rusty Groth. He saw and heard nothing, nor was he asked. But in his reenactment with police on 13 July 2012... he gave a garbled, almost incoherent account, which I reproduce here, as it does corroborate claims by Bidner and Anderson. Apologies for the audio quality, it was beyond my control. These are his words and his voice.
So you're back at camp?
Yep.
You're back with Bruce's car?
Yep.
Bruce's dog's there?
Yep.
There's only yourself and Tremaine?
Yep.
And you've been told that Dan has left?
Yes.
What did you do after that?
And he said, "Where you been?" I said, "I explained what I did and that." And he said, "Oh, well, we were here." And I said, "He said, oh," I said, "oh, what happened?" I said, "I heard first shot, then the break, then and then the second one went." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, the vehicle went past where we first met up, first departed from each other." He said, "Went up there, done a U-turn, and went back in, and never come back in." And that's when I got up to walk. He said, "He got up to go and see where Bruce was in that area."
Yep.
And he seen Danny coming down the hill.
Yep.
They met up, they went and had a bit of look, and they said, "Right." They went back, headed back towards camp. But Denny, well, I think he went and lead, and Jermaine was going to have a look around to see if he could find anything, Bruce.
In case you missed it, you hear him say around the 42nd mark, "The people went past where we first met up and departed from each other, and it went up and done a U-ey and come back." I suggest if asked today, at least one of the prospectors would confirm they did hear the Struby Ute go along the earlobe road. They did hear it drive up and down the steep ravine. One of them may have even seen it at the bottom of the ravine, loading something onto the tray. A clanging sound. I'll discuss the clang evidence in a future episode.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Why didn't they say so earlier, you would surely wonder? Because no one asked them would be their answer. That appeared to be the go-to line on the odd occasions there was a challenge about the ever-changing storyline. In reality, the evidence given by all three prospectors was completely at odds with the Crown case. The Crown produced no evidence that Stephen Struba and Diane Wilson drove down to the second crime scene. None at all. This is what Prosecutor Rees said on day 6 of the trial. These are his words, but not his voice.
This is an inferential case. Sorry, circumstantial case, full of inferences. And here, the Crown cannot say who did what. The inference is that both accused arrived at the gully.
Full of inferences, it certainly was. And full of speculation as well, I say. Sorry, Prosecutor Rees. The evidence from your witnesses showed quite categorically the defendants did not go down the ravine to the gully. The evidence showed the defendants turned around some 20 metres or so after Diane fired the first shot. Why was that never placed in front of the jury? What did Prosecutor Rees say in summing up about this aspect of the Crown case? Very little, actually. At page 7, he said,
Mr. Schuller was shot in the region wherever he was last seen.
And just to be clear, and in case you have forgotten, you know the primary crime scene where there was no blood or other forensic or physical evidence he was ever there.
Made his way to where the burnt patches are. Then there was a second shot. And as I say, ladies and gentlemen, the kill shot, you may infer.
There is that word again. Infer. Perhaps the good prosecutor can infer when and how the second shot supposedly occurred when the evidence showed the Strubers were never in the gully. And later, he said this, and again, these are his words, but not his voice.
Sounds are coming from the direction of that vehicle, ladies and gentlemen. Anderson and Bidner hear the vehicle start up and move. Then, depending on whose evidence, there's a 5 to 15 minute delay.
He did not add there, the vehicle only travelled 20 metres. I wonder why.
Then what? Second shot? Anderson tells you he heard the vehicle go off in a northerly direction.
That comment was sort of half correct. You just heard what was actually said, but it is worth repeating again.
I then heard the car start up again. I heard it travelling along the road. I could not see it from where I was, but from the noise it was travelling back down the river from the way it had originally come back towards the homestead, Palmerville Station.
So it travelled north for a short distance, then turned around and travelled south. A shame the jury did not hear that. I find it difficult to believe, but it is true. The barristers devoted more than 23 pages of legal argument to whether the bush basher could negotiate that ravine to the second crime scene. 23 pages on whether it could get there. And 0 pages on whether the bush basher actually did get there. 0 pages. And the barristers concluded it could negotiate the ravine, providing the vehicle was in low range, first gear, crawling along with the engine revving loudly. There was never any mention of driving the registered Land Cruiser up and down the ravine. The ridiculous thing was this. Everyone was seemingly so focused on whether the bush basher could drive up and down that ravine, everyone forgot to ask whether it actually did drive up and down the ravine. No one, and I mean no one, asked that simple question. Who saw and or heard the Struber vehicle travel up and down that ravine? Unbelievable. and what was known to the defence, but of course never came out at trial, was that Stephen Struber was awaiting arrival of gearbox parts to repair the gearbox of the unregistered Land Cruiser. You may recall the police mechanic said he could not get the vehicle into first or second gear at all, whether it be two-wheel drive or four-wheel drive high or four-wheel drive low. Those parts duly arrived and the gearbox was repaired in the period from their arrest to when the police officer drove it down the ravine 3 months later. The prosecutor also had this to say at page 10.
Look at the admissions. Termite mounds that had been knocked over and had gouge marks. The gouge marks are consistent with being made by a metal component on the undercarriage of the unregistered Land Cruiser. An examination of the gouge marks established a positive comparison between test marked cast taken from the vehicle, test marked cast taken from the termite mound.
The good prosecutor did not explain how that was arrived at, considering the evidence was the vehicle was never in that ravine. I am sure photographs were taken of the actual casts of the anthill and the vehicle undercarriage for comparison purposes, although I have not seen any photographs of them yet. I have trawled through some 500 crime scene photos looking for them. There are a small number of photographs of anthills, but no close-up photographs. There are no photographs of the undercarriage of the unregistered Land Cruiser. There are photographs of a metal bar protruding out the side of the vehicle in front of the front axle. The best description I can give is it was similar to the spear tip of a javelin sporting pole. There are no photographs of any comparison between that spear tip, if that was the mark referred to, or any other part of the undercarriage together with the anthill. I will continue my search for this material and keep you updated. If there was a claim the offenders returned at a later time in the registered Land Cruiser and set fire to the grass at the second crime scene, that would only fly if it could be shown the unregistered Land Cruiser had been at the bottom of the ravine at the time of Bruce's disappearance. And there is no evidence, and never has been evidence, that was the case. Inferences aside, of course, Mr. Prosecutor. But again, I will continue searching for that material. The prosecutor continued.
Do you know what else there is? There's cowpats. Cowpats with tyre impressions that match the unregistered vehicle.
Actually, what the admission sheet stated was, quote, could have been made by the tyres on that vehicle or any other tyre with similar tread characteristics. Similarly, I did not see any comparison photographs of how the conclusion was reached that the cow pads matched the registered Land Cruiser. Not that it is relevant any longer anyway. That evidence did not apply to the unregistered Land Cruiser. And you may recall from the last episode, the police officer approached defence counsel after the trial and provided a second statement that the unregistered Land Cruiser did not make the tracks down the ravine. The prosecutor also later said this.
Now, a lot has been said about the driving of the unregistered vehicle down the slope.
Actually, the only conversation about driving the unregistered vehicle down the slope related to the police officer driving it down the ravine 3 months after the disappearance of Bruce Shuler. Nothing was ever said about Struber or Wilson driving the vehicle down the slope anywhere. On page 12, the prosecutor continued.
Tremaine hears the vehicle start again and heads in the direction of the gully.
Again, only half correct. You have heard what Tremaine said about the vehicle, the distance it travelled, and the direction it took. On the bottom of page 16, the prosecutor also said,
"The witness put Struber and Wilson at the gully. Diane is seen with the firearm. A shot is heard after she is seen. All three of them hear that shot. Stephen is seen driving that vehicle. The vehicle is heard driving to the direction of the burnt patches. There was a second shot."
Technically, that was correct. The vehicle was heard driving to the direction of the burnt patches, because the ghost evidence that it stopped and turned around was never placed before the jury. Defence Barrister Trevino had an opportunity to set the record straight, to tell the jury the Struber Ute only drove 20 metres and not 200 metres, that it was never at the bottom of the ravine or at the creek bed. But he said this instead.
"The Crown rely on two items to suggest that they were made by the unregistered Land Cruiser: the mould of the termite mound and the cowpat bushes. But neither of those matters take the Crown very far in analysis. In respect to the termite mound, read the whole of that paragraph, because it finishes with essentially any tool for the underneath of any vehicle could have caused that scraping. In respect to the mould in the cowpat, that could have been made by any vehicle with a tyre with similar tread characteristics. So ultimately, I suggest to you that the forensic evidence proves very little apart from, perhaps, Mr. Schooler's presence in that gully."
What he didn't say was there is no evidence produced to show the unregistered Land Cruiser or the registered Land Cruiser went anywhere near that ravine. What a missed opportunity for the jury to hear all the evidence. And what about the other evidence? Apart from the evidence of two prospectors, there was no physical or forensic evidence to say Bruce Schuler was ever at the first crime scene. And what about the second crime scene? Up until now, I had been thinking it was a staged crime scene. What if that was where Bruce Schuler was the entire time until he met his fate? Think about that. Zero evidence placed him at the first crime scene. At the second crime scene, there was his DNA on a burnt match, other burnt matches found. I know Fiona said he hated prospectors who burnt grass, but did he burn the grass there? How else did his DNA find its way onto a match? How did his DNA find its way onto the old slug found under the dirt and leaves? It certainly didn't fall out of the film canister, that is for sure. The police photograph of the canister in situ shows the lid was secured on the canister. How did the twine and the film canister, both with his DNA, come to be found there? If they fell out of his pockets when they moved the body, whoever they were, there were no drag marks, scuff marks, disturbed soil, disturbed twigs, disturbed leaves, no blood. Police obviously considered all this, as they had all three surviving prospectors confirm they had not been to that area before Bruce disappeared. Those claims are simply inconsistent with the evidence. It is inconceivable Bruce ran there in terror and all that evidence was found there. It is far more consistent with him prospecting in that area when he met his demise. Anderson said he heard a high-powered rifle shot travel a long distance. What happened to the .357 Magnum revolver shot? And why hide the revolver if you were never at the crime scene and you never killed Bruce Schuler? But what about the tyre marks and knocked-over trees on the ravine? Who made those? And when? I have no idea. We know Struber didn't make them. So many questions about that scene and the steep ravine down to it. We have a bizarre situation where the Crown witnesses told police the vehicle did not go down or up the ravine, but the jury never heard it. We have forensic evidence that the unregistered Land Cruiser did not leave the tyre tracks in the bush, but the prosecutor asked the jury to infer that the offenders were at the gully. Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson, on the Crown's very own star witnesses, did not travel to the gully via the ravine. Therefore, they never killed or carried away Bruce Shula. Therefore, the entire Crown case is a lie, a charade, a house of cards. If Diane Wilson and Stephen Struber were nowhere near the gully on that day, then ipso facto, they were not on any part of that ridge at all on that day. Who made the tracks down the ravine? I have no idea. I wonder if investigators asked all police who were on the property whether they drove a police vehicle down that steep ravine to where the evidence was found. You know, sort of, it was too far to walk, so let's drive there scenario. I wonder if police checked the tyres owned by Groth, Anderson and Bidner, although they would have had difficulty checking Bidner's tyres. You will recall all the prospectors travelled to Mareeba on the 10th of July 2012, the day after Bruce went missing. That night, they gave statements to police. The next day, Bidner replaced the tyres on his 4x4 ute in Mareeba. In a statement dated 1 October 2012, less than 3 months later, he told police he replaced the tyres on his car next day on 11 July. He said this, "The tyres were due to be replaced. I had mixed tread on the patrol because I had blown one, so they needed to be replaced." You will recall Robert Reed wrote a book, Murder on the River of Gold. At page 86 of Reed's book, this was Bidner's comments. "It was a big night. We stayed at Dave Wright's place, and next thing, I get busted for not roadworthy tyres." That's interesting, Denny. Which was it? You received a ticket for defective vehicle, but forgot to mention that to the police officer? Or your tyres needed replacing because you had a blown tyre? Do I need to add here that is another red flag? In the last episode, you heard the coroner's findings from 2018. When you read the full coroner's report, guess what? There is no mention of the vehicle travelling down to the gully. In fact, there is no mention of the vehicle travelling anywhere. The report was silent after the point where the prospectors heard the second shot. Where does all this new evidence lead us? In the last episode, you heard the discrepancies with the firearms. Just now, you have heard about the ghost evidence. The Struber ute only travelling 20 metres after Diane supposedly fired a shot at Bruce Shula. You need to ask yourself this question. Could you place your trust in the evidence of the three amigos? Could you place your trust in the story Prosecutor Reese put to the jury? Virtually none of the evidence you have heard over the last two episodes was heard by the jury. And it all should have been. If it had been, would the jury have convicted the defendants? I say very unlikely. But I go further and ask this question. On what evidence did the Crown prosecute Struber and Wilson? Perhaps Prosecutor Reese can explain on what basis he actually prosecuted those people. I am confident he will be asked that very question in coming months. I want to take a moment to consider the evidence against Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson in a dispassionate, clinical manner. What evidence is there now that implicates Diane Wilson and Stephen Struber in the murder of Bruce Shula? Actually, none. Nothing. No physical evidence. No forensic evidence, no admissions, no witnesses. And what evidence connects Diane Wilson and Stephen Struber to crime scenes 1 and 2. Nothing. No physical evidence, no forensic evidence, no admissions, and again, no witnesses. And at this point, I want you to sit back and draw a deep breath. This case gets really weird. Like nothing I've ever seen or heard before. I had to check I was broadcasting on the True Crime Channel and not broadcasting on the Fiction Channel. Although, to be honest, this story would go just as well on the Fiction Channel. It puts a whole new spin on the phrase, you couldn't make this shit up. I'm talking about the prospector's evidence, of course. The prospectors never told police they saw Struber and Wilson murder Bruschula. Dare I say that word again? They may have inferred Struber and Wilson murdered him. They may have inferred Struber and Wilson disposed of his body. But they never said that. The prospectors merely told police they saw Struber and Wilson turn up near where they last saw their new best mate Bruce. On the evidence of Prospector Bidner, Diane Wilson fired a gun in the direction of Bruce. That water became very muddy with the evidence of Anderson and Groth. Then all three prospectors heard a second shot and later saw or heard the Struber vehicle depart the scene. Coincidentally or not, Bruce was never seen again. The prospectors never said Struber or Wilson shot at Bruce. They never said they killed him. They never said they took his body away. And of course we know the police never found any scientific evidence, forensic evidence, or other evidence to implicate Struber or Wilson in the murder anyway. It begs the question, who decided Struber and Wilson murdered Bruce? Well, of course the police did. And realistically speaking, on the balance of probability, Bruce Shula is deceased. 11.5 years later, there is no evidence of him being alive. That is compelling evidence he is dead. But the simple fact of the matter is, there is no evidence at all to connect Diane Wilson and Stephen Struber to his disappearance. In its rawest form, it is a case of Tremaine Anderson and Denny Bidner saying Struber and Wilson were in the area where Bruce was last seen, but not at the actual crime scene, versus Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson saying they were not anywhere near there. And they all had a conflicted past and a motive. More motive than Struber and Wilson ever had. But that is it. Zero evidence. I previously said I could regale you with further inconsistencies in the evidence of the Crown witnesses, but why bother? The truth is right there. After further consideration, I believe we do need to explore more closely the relationship between the prospectors and the convicted persons to see just how big and how many inconsistencies there were in the evidence of the three amigos. You may recall I said this in episode 1. No two witnesses are going to be able to ever give accounts that are consistent in every respect. You might expect some divergence in the finer details, but for the big ticket items, significant events, you'd expect there to be some level of consistency between their accounts. And there are any number of commonalities where you would be seeing consistency. And I went on to detail the commonalities. Recently, a police officer said this to me in respect of the prospector's evidence. They were put under enormous pressure by us during the investigation and were forced to give numerous versions/statements. And of course there are inconsistencies because they are human beings, not robots. I would challenge you to find a witness in any court case where there are not inconsistencies when the witness has given multiple accounts/statements and then given evidence in court. I acknowledge and accept that comment in the spirit in which it was given. I understand it and I am conscious of it when I review evidence. I do repeat what the prosecutor said in summing up, I concede there were inconsistencies in their evidence. I'll analyse and compare the evidence of all the principal players in this case and present the findings in a future episode. In episode 1, I made comment about wrongful convictions and miscarriages of justice. I made the following comments in that episode. And in case you are wondering what can cause a wrongful conviction, it varies from case to case. I believe, however, it is never just one factor, it is always a number of issues that align like the planets. And from my experience and study, yes, I am fascinated by wrongful conviction cases. Common factors include, but are not limited to, witness misidentification, witnesses lying under oath, tunnel vision by investigators, poor police procedures or investigation, misconduct by police and or prosecutors, and poor legal representation of the defendant. So perhaps you can consider whether this case ticks any or how many of those boxes. Fiona Split, I say this to you. You need to demand a full coronial hearing to get to the bottom of what happened at Palmerville on those 2 days. I do not believe we have heard the truth to this time. Until you have an inquest with witnesses called who will have no option but to answer hard questions put to them, Bruce will not be coming home to you. You also need to be demanding a full and fresh murder investigation be commenced immediately. Do not agree to a police review of the original investigation. They never end well. For anyone other than the police, that is. I have previously related to you the farcical review of the original investigation of the Leanne Holland murder. And I personally can do without further criticism from the Queensland Police Service and being threatened with arrest for publicly airing this mess. In the Holland case, police investigated police. What could possibly go wrong? Fast forward 2 years, the Queensland Police Service gave themselves a 5-star review. Despite the murder conviction being quashed by the Court of Appeal and universal judicial criticism of the original police investigation. A strong, circumstantial and forensic case, until it wasn't. And I'll let you, the listener, decide why the Queensland Government, supported by the Queensland Police Service, for the past 32 years, have refused to hold an inquest into the murder of Leanne Holland, despite being lawfully obliged to do so. And that festering mess is the subject of a documentary to be broadcast by TV station Channel 9 in February 2024. Look out for it. And when the police ask you, Fiona, and they will, where is the evidence the Strubers did not murder Bruce, you could instead be asking the police, where is the evidence they did murder Bruce, apart from the dodgy claims by the prospectors, that is. And when you are told, as you will be, a jury convicted Struber and Wilson, and the convictions were upheld by the Court of Appeal and the High Court of Australia, your reply could include, this would not be the first case that has gone as far as the High Court of Australia to be found to be a miscarriage of justice and wrongful conviction. You could add, in fact, most cases go to the Court of Appeal and High Court before being overturned. I am not making wild, unfounded allegations here, nor conspiracy theories. I set out to analyse and tell the story of this murder based on the known evidence and instead stumbled across a huge amount of evidence that for reasons best known to others has remained, well, ghost evidence until now. If I was a relative or friend of Diane Wilson or Stephen Struber, I would also be screaming from the rooftops. This matter, this mess, needs to go to the CCC, the Crime and Corruption Commission, for investigation of possible perjury and other misconduct, especially relating to the ghost evidence. I have placed on the Facebook pages material produced by the CCC. That material details their charter of service and matters they are entitled to investigate. I'm certain this matter falls under that charter. The media needs to be briefed. This is a story that the general public needs to hear. The sad reality is, if I were an employee of a media organisation, this story would be front page material for weeks. I am hoping the Struber families, the Shuler families, and the Wilson families can make that happen. Solicitors for Diane Wilson and Stephen Struber need to be instructed. An urgent petition for pardon needs to be delivered to the Governor-General on behalf of Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson. I believe a letter of complaint needs to be sent to the Queensland Law Society. I also believe the Queensland Coroner needs to be informed evidence was potentially withheld from the coroner in this case. The Queensland Premier needs to be alerted to this disgrace for a criminal prosecution. It was, after all, this government that introduced the no body, no parole legislation because of this very case. The Premier needs to be asked how that legislation is working out for them in light of this case. The Queensland Police Service Commissioner needs to intervene. A proper murder investigation needs to be commenced immediately. And I say the same to you families. Do not agree to a police review of the original investigation. I personally can do without the drama. Your local Queensland politician who represents you needs to raise this matter in Parliament. To the men and women of the Queensland Police Service and the Office of Director of Public Prosecutions, I say this. Perhaps it is time to do some soul-searching and reflection over the use or misuse of ghost evidence. But we also need to address the elephant in the room. If Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson did not murder Bruce Shuler, who did? That's not for me to say. I am just the messenger. But someone needs to be asking that question, and soon, and very loudly. From my personal experience with previous cases, the Queensland Government and the Queensland Police Service will be in denial for months or years over this case. They will not accept a mistake has been made. They will not apologise. They will obfuscate. They will aggressively defend their position. They will go on the attack. They will hide behind the jury verdict. What they will be really saying is they do not wish to address the issue. The evidence shows this was a wrongful conviction of both Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson, and a miscarriage of justice. But hey, I'm not a lawyer, I'm just the messenger. Is our justice system that broken that it takes a podcaster to highlight wrongful convictions and miscarriages of justice? And over 11 years after the event? How long would this mess have festered for had I not broadcast this podcast? The evidence the Strubers were at the gully was a lie. There were many lies and few truths told during the trial of Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson. Two truths stand out, in my opinion. Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson were telling the truth when they told the court they were not guilty of murdering Bruce Shuler. Please join me in episode 6, where I speak with Fiona Split. I also speak with one of the prospectors. I will be joined by retired solicitor Jeff Johnson, who will review the evidence as presented in the case from a legal perspective. If you have any information, comment or feedback, contact me at my Facebook presence, Graham Crowley Podcast Investigations. Alternatively, you can contact me at my email, graham5353@live.com. If you follow the podcast, you will be advised when a further episode is released. Please rate and review the podcast. It does help spread the story and make it visible to others who follow true crime podcasts and may have an interest in this case. You just simply go to the podcast app, scroll down and click on review. Please tell your family and friends. This podcast was made possible with the grateful assistance of the Acast Creator Network. Music by Janet G, which can be found on YouTube. If you like the podcast, you can support me for the one-off cost of a cup of coffee by transferring funds to Commonwealth Bank 064180, account 100645008. You'll find all my contact details in the show notes at the end of each episode. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.